Hey, Crawlspace community, do you love true crime podcasts but could do without all the chatty banter? Are you intrigued by what's underneath our collective true crime obsession and want to hear field experts, authors, and content creators weigh in on the subject? Well, it might be time for you to kill the small talk and join the dialogue. I'm Rebecca Sebastian, host of Dialogue, a true crime conversation, which is a weekly podcast where I speak with fascinating guests from the true crime world and the criminal justice system. And yes, I have interviewed Tim and Lance, and you don't want to miss that episode. Together, we explore the genre itself and attempt to answer the why of true crime and the question, what are we even talking about when we talk about true crime? Join me every Wednesday for a new episode and a killer conversation. Dialogue is part of the Crawlspace Network and available wherever you listen.
You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
And I'm Bill Thomas.
And we are pleased to bring you a second episode with retired FBI special agent Bobby Chacone with more tales from chasing down the mafia in New York City's field office. Bobby also talks about his work with the FBI's dive team, as well as his transition to writing for CBS's hit series Criminal Minds and various other procedurals.
More good news. As we mentioned last week, our long gestating television series, The Lover's Lane Murders, covering the Colonial Parkway murders, is going to be launching on the Oxygen Network on Thursday and Friday night, February 11th and 12th, two episodes each night. So it'll be a two-hour special on a Thursday night, February 11th, Friday night, February 12th. Four episodes in total of Lover's Lane Murders, and it's a deep dive on the Colonial Parkway murders. It's on the Oxygen Network.
And Bill, I understand that you appear in several episodes, do you not?
I think I'm in episode number one, and then I acted as a consulting producer throughout the four episodes as the subject matter expert, shell answer man, as they say, where I would answer questions off camera for the investigators and our various guests. It was a really enjoyable experience, and I think the producers did an amazing job putting the show together. I think people are going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I think so, too. We were both fortunate enough to spend time on the set, and we got to know the experts, Jim Clemente, Maureen O'Connell, Lonnie Coombs, Laura Petler, and they are great people. So we were very fortunate to have such excellent experts working on this series.
What's also very exciting is that Kristen Dilley herself appears as herself in the television series as well, talking about the case and offering some of her insight.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
In case you haven't figured it out, listeners, Kristen doesn't love appearing on television, although she looks great and sounds great and offers very worthwhile things to say, as she does here. She just isn't crazy about being on television.
I'm a behind-the-scenes type of person, but it was a lot of fun, and I had a great time getting to know the cast and crew. So we hope you all really enjoy Lover's Lane Murders, and we'll tune in to the Oxygen Network on February 11th and 12th for a two-night double feature. And in other true crime news, we need to offer some props to our friends at Authorum Labs, who are also sponsors of our podcast. They have cracked another case that we are particularly interested in. This one is the case that is known as Pecos Jane Doe from 1966. Pecos Jane Doe was a woman who was found in a swimming pool in the Roper's Motel in Pecos, Texas. She had registered with an unknown male using the names Mr. and Mrs. Russell Batoon and was found hours later floating dead in the hotel pool, at which point her companion had checked out of the hotel and was never seen again. The young lady was finally identified by the folks at Othram Labs as Jolaine Hemme. Jolaine Hemme of Kansas City, who ostensibly had left to start a new and more interesting life, but unfortunately came to a very tragic end. The folks at Othram worked quite hard trying to identify her, and thankfully she has been and now has her name back. So congratulations to the folks at Othram for all of the great work that you all continue to do. We are so proud of you.
As always, we want to thank you for your ongoing support of Mind Over Murder. We really appreciate your listening, enjoying the podcast, telling your friends about Mind Over Murder. And part of that is ratings and reviews. And I know we ask frequently, but please take a few minutes, go to your favorite podcast platform or platforms, plural, and offer us some thoughts about what you like about the podcast. To that end, I thought we would read a couple of reviews that kind of struck us in a good way over the last couple of weeks. So here's a couple of sample reviews that we've seen recently. Here's a first one. Such a wonderful tribute to horrible crimes. 5 stars. It is hard to hear about people's loved ones being brutally murdered, but the research and thoughtfulness that this podcast presents allow the listener to better understand the crime and the problems encountered throughout the investigation. Keep it up.
Thank you so much. We're always happy to get a wonderful review such as that.
Well, thank you. That's from Let's Go Buffalo via Apple Podcasts. Another review says, love this podcast. Well, thank you. It's a 5-star review, entertaining, full of factual information. And that's by Glamour by Kim via Apple Podcasts. Thank you, Kim. And then finally, we got a chuckle out of this one. You may recall we had our friend Lisa Zambetti, casting director to the stars, on a few weeks ago, and just a terrific 2-part episode. Lisa Zambetti has restored my faith, says Barb McMurderino. I like the name.
Yeah, me too.
I think she's a fan of...
My favorite murder. Sorry. It took me a minute.
Barb is obviously a fan of My Favorite Murder, and she gave us 5 stars and said, loved listening to Lisa talk about casting an actor after, quote, seeing him in a Chekhov play, unquote. As an actor and teacher, I often tell my students, quote, no industry people are coming down to your weird Chekhov play downtown. Get yourself into an improv troupe, unquote. Lisa, real actors everywhere. Thank you. So you mentioned this to Lisa Zambetti, and she didn't believe us.
Yeah, she was a little surprised that somebody would write a review for us that contains such glowing praise for her. But Lisa, you definitely deserve it. And we will make sure that you get a copy of this review so that you can like frame it and hang it up on your wall or something like that.
Absolutely. So people on a true crime podcast, another true crime podcast, Mind Over Murder, are talking about how terrific you are. And that doesn't surprise either one of us.
Absolutely not. You are fantastic, Lisa, and we love you to death. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Mind Over Murder. We'll see you next time. And we're back with retired Special Agent Bobby Chacone to give us more tales from the trenches. Bobby, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's much better than being told that Bobby Chacone's going to give us tales from the crypt or something.
Yeah. I have those too, but I'll hold off on those.
So, Bobby, last time you were talking to us about your work in counterterrorism. So talk to us a little bit about that. What kind of training did you receive?
Well, there's two main avenues within counterterrorism that we were focused on. And that is, one is, you know, clearly the investigations, right, of counterterrorism. That's not the avenue that I was in. I was in the preventative avenue of counterterrorism. So, for example, one of my first big assignments was to go to Salt Lake City, Utah at the 2002 Winter Olympics. And I went a couple of months before and I was assigned there on a long-term, what we call TDY or temporary duty assignment. And I worked with Secret Service, with the State Department, with the state police in Utah, the public Department of Public Safety, with the Salt Lake City Police Department. And we had working groups on how to keep the venues of the Olympics safe. And that is through access control and through surveillance and things like that. And so we did a tremendous amount of work in, for example, one of the things I did was I went into a neighborhood around every single venue, and there were in the Winter Olympics probably 20 or 30 venues. And I mapped, and this is again, 2002, doesn't sound like it was long ago, but you're working with much cruder software and things like that. But I mapped every camera, every Department of Transportation camera, every ATM camera, every convenience store security camera, every gas station that was around the outside of, because we already knew what was on the inside of a venue. We knew where the cameras were because we could control that and we could put them up ourselves. But suppose people were running out of a venue and somebody saw a guy with a red backpack and a blue hat on, and he was running this way and that way. And you could instantly call it up in our command post and say, well, there's a camera in a convenience store in the corner. He must have run by there. Let's look at that. And so we had almost instant access. And every time you hit on one of those things from my work, I would have had the number, the phone number, the 24-hour phone number of the person who has control of that camera, how to get in touch with them, where to meet them to get that footage and things like that. So I also had to know back then what kind of recording medium they were recording on, because some of them were still recording on the old VHS tapes.
Oh, yeah.
Beta tapes, right? And so back in our command post, I had to make sure that we had VHS playback machines and beta playback machines and everything, all the different types of things. So that took months to go and meet with those people and look around at different cameras. But by the time the Olympics happened, we had that all wired into our command post and the mapping software so that we could tell if an event happened. Luckily, nothing happened. So that's the counter. I worked with the U.S. military. We had counter sniper teams in Salt Lake on the rooftops and things and stuff. So I wasn't involved in the counterterrorism investigative side. I was in the kind of hardened target side of counterterrorism, more of the nuts and bolts logistics of that. And that led to me going and being tasked with going to Greece and living in Greece for a year prior to the 2004 Olympics and being a consultant, an FBI consultant for the Greek authorities who were doing the same thing at the Summer Olympics. Now, the Summer Olympics obviously is about 3 times the size of the Winter Olympics.
Right.
That means there's 3 times the amount of venues, 3 times the amount of athletes and stuff. And so it's a much bigger operation. So we had a group of 8 countries, US, Canada, Australia, England, France, Germany, Spain. I might be leaving somebody out, but we would meet weekly at one of the different embassies in Athens, and we would have these plans and what everybody was bringing to the table. Where the FBI sent, I think, about 125 agents for the 45 days surrounding the Olympics. I was there for about a year or about 8 months prior to the Olympics. Me and a couple other guys formed the core group, and then we would bring in, you know, SWAT teams or different teams for weeks at a time to do training with the Greeks. And then everybody came back for the actual games. And so we worked with the State Department, the Diplomatic Security Service, the DSS agents. We obviously work with Secret Service. I know like the mayor of New York came over in his NYPD detail. We coordinated with them and stuff like that. So that led me to that. So the counterterrorism that I was involved in, that led me to 2005, a year later, being tasked with going to Iraq and teaching those kind of counterterrorism efforts at the Baghdad Police Academy. So I spent, you know, several months, about 4 or 5, maybe 6 months in Iraq in 2005, which was early in the war, teaching at the Baghdad Police Academy. Now there, I did teach some investigations because we were teaching them basic investigations, which I learned every agent learns to do. So I was teaching them an interview and interrogation and surveillance and counter surveillance, you know, and things like that. So we taught them that, and then we taught them the other stuff as well, how to harden a target, you know, how to do, you know, counter terrorism operations. If the terrorists are going to do this, how do you counter it, you know, before it happens and stuff. So, yeah, so that just kind of, those were my steps in the counterterrorism arena.
Unlike investigative work that you've done, in these examples, a success means no event.
Yeah.
In other words, nothing happens that is concerning or dangerous or...
Right, or an event foiled, you know, that we can't talk about, right? There have been events that we foiled at some of these events that I'm talking about that will never be known.
Right,
And so because, you know, you got to remember too, the FBI walks that fine balance where you want to be not lauded for your successes, but you want Congress to know that the money they're giving us And every year, you know, we go to Congress, we ask for more money, and we say it's because of this and this, and we want to show our successes, but Congress is a sieve, and it leaks constantly. And so, you know, if one of the objectives of terrorism, of a terrorism activity, is to instill fear and terror in a populace, then simply by telling you that, hey, this is what happened and we foiled it, could cause panic and terror in people. For example, and this is a hypothetical, this is not something that happened, but suppose we, you know, around Thanksgiving, we foil the plot to bomb the Mall of America with backpacks or whatever, you know. Yes, we're a big success. Congress slaps us on the back, gives us more money next year. But if the people know that there was this planned attack, every mall in America would probably shut down. Half the people wouldn't go to the mall that year, and you'd kill the Christmas shopping season, right? So they would achieve a measure of their success, even though we foiled the plot. And so we have to walk that fine balance and not letting some of our successes be made public, because if we did, they would get some benefit from that. And we don't want them to get that benefit. So we do that sometimes with classified briefings, but classified briefings to Congress people are not, you know, they're not responsible enough. I hate to say it, to keep classified information classified. If they can use it to their political advantage, no matter who they are, they will do that. And so you walk that fine line. You want Congress to know we're having these successes and we're using the money you give us wisely, and we're having successes with that money, spending that money in the ways that we spend it. And you balance that with not telling them everything, because then the stuff leaks and the terrorism, you know, the terrorists gain a kind of small measure of their objective.
So I understand the delicacy of things like that. What's your take on post 9/11, the FBI being redeployed as an anti-terrorism agency? Was that a difficult transition, do you believe, for the agency to shift its focus?
I think that the where we had the problems were, we approach intelligence work much differently than the CIA. And working with the CIA was very difficult because of that. We had almost a 180 difference. And that is that in the FBI, if I was the lead agent on something, on a group, I would be tasking my intelligence analysts to provide me intelligence or go find intelligence, analyze all the intelligence on a particular thing. In the CIA, it's the opposite. It's the intelligence analyst that runs it, and they task the agents with going and filling the holes. Go out in the field and find me this piece of information, that piece of information, because my intelligence picture has a few holes in it. And you're the agent, you go out there. So it's really reversed. So, you know, the agents almost work for the analysts, or in the FBI, the analysts work for the agents. And our purpose of gathering information is much different, right? The product, the end product that we need is something that we can put before a grand jury and get an indictment and get a conviction and at a trial and put somebody in jail. Whereas the CIA doesn't have that accountability. They simply issue a report, they write a report to Washington. Now, a little more nowadays, they use actionable intelligence working with the military, where if they can get actionable intelligence, what they call actionable intelligence, they can use the military to carry out strikes and things like that. So they do sometimes have to do that. But again, they don't have the accountability of appearing before a federal judge like our folks have to do and be responsible for their actions and be responsible for everything that you put before a jury being constitutionally sound. And so, you know, that's where we differed with the enhanced interrogation techniques and things like that, where the FBI would not participate in those things because, you know, we can't, we're accountable for this stuff in an open judicial forum. And we can't get up there and say we violated the Constitution or the Geneva Convention or anything like that, because the forum where we're going to be held accountable is a federal court and with a federal judge and a defendant and a very aggressive defense attorney, you know, calling us on all our actions. Not that we would do it anyway, because I think we have somewhat of a better moral compass, but we did run into those things. My good friend Ali Soufan has a great book about it. He was right at the front lines of all that stuff. And there was growing pains, you know, working with it. One of the things that came down after 9/11 was that wall between counterintelligence and the counterterrorism investigation. So we had criminal investigators doing the counterterrorism. They were trying to, and they had indicted bin Laden, right? These were criminal cases, but there was still people on the other side of the wall, FBI agents working with the CIA on the intelligence side, who weren't passing that information over the wall prior to 9/11. And that has changed now. And so that's a big change. Now, that wasn't a law. There was no statute that prevented that information from coming over. That was simply a policy that was misguided, in my opinion. and caused the working agents on the JTTF in New York not to be in receipt of valuable information that was sitting down at CIA headquarters, that obviously two of the 19 hijackers were living in the United States for some time, and they knew it. And we knew who they were, but they didn't tell us they were in the United States, living in San Diego and stuff. And so, you know, you had people like Hamzy, you know, who were two of the hijackers. And they just, we weren't told that. And I'm not saying that things would have been different, but they certainly could have been and stuff. So I think we've adapted well to the larger role, but I think we were doing it beforehand. I think JTTF was, like I said, they were on the ground in Yemen. They were on the ground all over Europe and all over Africa, chasing Al-Qaeda down and indicting some of them. And yeah, so I think that the calls to break up the FBI into like an MI5 and MI6 type thing like they have in the UK were very misplaced. And that that would have further bifurcated the flow of information, if you will, and further made the problem even worse. And somehow, I think now we've kind of overcome much of that problem on, you know, on that transferring of information back and forth. So
I want to make sure we get into a discussion about your program, the FBI Dive Team program. How did you go about putting forth the idea that the FBI needed a forensic dive team? And tell us a little bit about the development of that team.
So when I got to the New York office in 1987, I didn't even know the FBI had a dive team, but there was one and it was in New York. And New York is the flagship office. It's got many more agents than any other office in the FBI. And it has a bigger budget because of that. And being in New York, it gets a lot of attention and a lot of publicity. But that being said, the FBI dive team was kind of a secret within the New York office. By 1995, they were getting so busy that they opened it up to the entire office. It was actually housed in a special operations branch of the office in New York. And that's only, those were the only agents that were allowed on the team. In 1995, they were so busy that they had to open it up to other agents, namely criminal agents like myself. And so they put an email around the office that said, hey, you want to join this team? There's only six of us. We're adding six more people, literally doubling the size of the team because the workload was increasing. So in 1995, I got on the team. In 1996, TWA Flight 800 crashes off of Long Island with 230 souls on board. It's a 747 out of Kennedy Airport bound for Paris, Texas. Bound for Paris, France. And that was a major, major underwater operation. And we participated in that with the U.S. Navy, with the Suffolk County PD, NYPD, every law enforcement agency in the Northeast, I think, took part at some point. But, you know, that was a baptism by fire. And that also made the FBI realize, we need this in-house. 1995, 96 timeframe. Now remember, what's also happening at the same time within the FBI at that time is the birth and emergence of the evidence response teams, which is what we call our CSI. Most people know it as CSI from the TV show. The FBI doesn't call it CSI, we call it ERT, evidence response team. So the laboratory had started this, you know, and Director Free had mandated that every one of the 56 FBI field offices had to establish an ERT, a forensic capability, a team of forensic agents that were trained by the laboratory to go out and to process crime scenes. And so, you know, this is the heyday. This is DNA is just coming into being and all these teams are really getting these specialized training. So the dive team is just behind the curve on that. So as this, we're being swept along with it. So we get put under the auspices of the ERT program of the laboratory division at the FBI lab in Quantico. I happen to be in the right place at the right time. I'm on this New York team. By 95, 96, 97, we're getting so busy that by 99, they say, we need somebody to do this full time. The team leader at the time, my team leader at the time, did not want to do it full time. He was part of a black bag squad. He was the guy that broke in and put, you know, wiretaps and phones and cameras and stuff places. He loved his job. And so he said, why don't you take it? Because you've been on the team 4 or 5 years now. You're a great diver, whatever. And so I took it and became the first full-time diver in the FBI history. And we built... They wanted me to build three other dive teams because dive teams are very expensive. You can't have them in every field office. So regionally, we put one in Miami, one in Los Angeles, and for political reasons, one got put in D.C. There's none in the Midwest. So those are the four teams, three on the East Coast. And so what I did was I wanted to do best practices. So I went to the U.S. Navy and I told them what we were doing. And then I went to NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they have divers. And I went to the EPA, who has hazmat divers. And I went to certain research universities who have underwater archaeological programs. So I went to the worlds of military, government diving, other police diving, academic diving, scientific diving, commercial diving, the divers in the Gulf of Mexico or the North Sea in Europe. And I just absorbed all there was to know about spending time underwater working. And we built a best practices program. We built a platform out. We said, here's what we need to do underwater. So here's how we're going to be able to do it safely. And so we went about building that program. It took me a couple of years traveling all around the country, talking to people in all facets of diving. And then we built the program. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be, you know, run the New York team when that happened. And then ultimately I went out to LA and ran the Los Angeles dive team. And I think we were on the forefront of like making this a profession. A lot of police departments had a couple of guys that were diving and maybe they'd go to Mexico for vacation a couple times a year and dive. But this now was going to become a profession. It was going to become, you know, there were going to be standards and protocols and procedures and stuff. And we established that with the help of people like NOAA and the EPA and the National Park Service. People understand National Park Service has a great dive program because they have all these deep water lakes, especially out here in the west part of the United States, that, you know, you have World War II planes down in them and you have different things that need to be protected and stuff. And so National Park Service, U.S. Navy, we went to the U.S. Army. U.S. Army has a very substantial dive program within it. We went to the Army in Fort Eustis, Virginia. We learned how to do cutting and welding underwater, and we learned all this cool stuff how to do underwater. And so we had two clients we served. We served the investigators and we served the lab, and we had to kind of make sure. And most of us were investigators prior to becoming divers. And so we knew the value of that evidence. And we had prosecutors and we had lab technicians, and we needed to serve both those masters in that. We had to get the evidence in a way that it could be subjected to scientific analysis in a lab, or else it's almost useless. But we also had to do that in a way that's constitutionally protected, so that the prosecutor will be able to, you know, introduce it in a court of law, either in a grand jury or to a regular jury, and it's not suppressed because it's gathered, it's collected legally, and the process is legally sound. So it had to be scientifically sound, and it had to be legally sound. And we did that, and I thought we did it to great success. And in those in the years after that, we did the space shuttle crash in 2003. We did the Lacey Peterson searches out here in California. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of searches, many of them, some of them were high profile, some of them were much less high profile, but they were all significant and substantial. And we didn't really know what we were getting into as we went down that road. It was all new territory for us. We ended up, you know, having to do a lot more child recoveries than we ever thought we would, you know, with the advent of the internet. Again, this is the time when the internet is mushrooming. What do we know about the internet? It makes our lives so much greater, but it also puts a tool in the hands of predators as well, right? So we had all these child abduction cases and things start to blow up based on the internet, which is a federal crime and things like that. So we got involved in, you know, in that. We didn't see that coming. You know, it was tough. It was tough. I'll admit it was tough. But we had such a good group of people. And by the time I retired in 2014, I knew every agent diver in the Bureau. There were 60 of them, I think, because there were four teams of 15. I had either helped in selecting or training all of them. We all train exactly the same way. So if I had a dive job with the LA team and I was going to Phoenix or I was going to Texas and I was short three divers, I could call my program manager in Quantico and he could reach out to the team leaders in DC or Miami or New York and say, hey, I need, who's available next week? Can you fly him to Texas and meet Bobby and go? So everybody's plug and play. Everybody knows each other, even though they're on one of the other teams. Doing the first half of my career in investigations, the second half in forensics, it was really a great way to round out in my career. I just loved it. I loved the dive program. I loved the work that we did. But yeah, it was very, very satisfying.
You're listening to Mind Over Murder. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors. One of the most frequent questions we're asked here at Mind Over Murder is, how can I help?
Thanks to Othram, a leading forensic DNA testing lab for law enforcement, you can get involved and help solve real cases.
If you have tested at a consumer genetics company, you can contribute your data to DNASolves.com. The process is easy and confidential, just two simple steps. Your DNA might be the missing piece that helps solve the identity of an unknown person.
Then Mind Over Murder will highlight cases Othram is working on to seek your crowdfunding support for DNA testing to help solve these cold cases.
Upload your DNA profile to DNASolves.com. It's easy, free, and confidential.
Then join Mind Over Murder as we help families find answers with Othram and DNASolves.com.
We're back here at Mind Over Murder.
I remember hearing about a case in Los Angeles where someone from the dive team had to go into the La Brea tar pits. Was that something that you advised on?
Yeah. I don't remember that particular case, but I remember being asked about the, I don't think we actually dove in the La Brea tar pits. I think we were asked if we could. There were cases where we were asked, like remember getting a case in Alabama where the farmer killed his wife and they thought he disposed of the murder weapon in this basically concrete tub that is about 8 feet deep, about 40 feet long and about 30 feet wide rectangle. And it's filled with pig waste.
I knew that we were going there.
Yeah. And it's now realize that this is solid waste at the bottom and it's about 10 feet deep. It's solid waste for a, sorry. So now this concrete tub is filled with pig waste and about the first foot and a half to 2 feet is solid. Then you get this gelatinous substance, substrate,
wow.
Right? And at the top you have maybe a foot or two of liquid. And I just told them, I said, we're not diving in that. We're not diving in. You can drag that. You can drain it. You can do whatever you want to do with it, but I'm not putting my divers in
no,
that water.
Talk about a health hazard. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
You know, I don't know what's in there, but you can, you know, that's a situation where we turned out. We don't like to turn down work, but that was a situation where, you know, I just said, no, there's other ways to search that place without putting divers in there.
Yet you and the dive team had done dives into all sorts of really dirty water and contaminated areas and that sort of thing.
Brooklyn, the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn was one of the notorious ones. I actually got a condition called costochondritis, which is a inflammation of the diaphragm. I got it from inhaling some bad water in the Anacostia River in DC. Oof. We were looking for an immigration attorney who had disappeared. And they found her sweater with a sleeve inside out, indicating that she had been pulled out of the sweater and stuff right at the river's edge. And and I remember, you know, we used full face masks, but coming in and out of the, and when we got out of the water, we would stand in this outdoor shower, and the fire department decon team mm-hmm. would spray us down with this foam and stuff. But it's never 100%. And I must have inhaled a little bit of the water and it made me sick for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. I couldn't dive. I couldn't even take a deep breath because the lining of my diaphragm muscle was inflamed, which pushed it up and caused upward pressure on my lungs. So I could never take a deep breath. And so you did kind of contract certain things and you did everything you could to stay safe. And we were generally safe. I mean, there were never any significant injuries to the team.
You referenced something a moment ago that some of that work has to be especially difficult from a psychological perspective, though, because I was thinking about some of the cases you just mentioned over the last few minutes, Bobby. You know, you're talking about you're doing the investigative follow-up work, looking for evidence and sometimes human remains in some pretty difficult situations. So a successful outcome could involve recovering a missing child or a murder victim. But was that difficult for the members of the team?
Sure, sure. You know, especially, like I said, the kids, the child recoveries, and anybody in law enforcement will tell you, you know, the child victims are always the toughest to deal with. And when we got them, they were particularly, you know, difficult because of the conditions of the bodies that were in. And oftentimes, obviously, when we as divers are putting our hands on those victims, we're the first ones to do so since the perpetrator did it. The very last person to touch them was the perpetrator. So you're bringing them home, and there's a deeply felt obligation on the part of the divers who do that kind of work to, you know, to recognize that and be solemn about it and do it in a way that's respectful. You have to do what you have to do, but you have to also do, you know, be mindful and respectful of the family and of that victim themselves. And oftentimes, you know, I hate to say it, but sometimes the terror of their last moments is frozen on their faces. And the only person that's going to see that is the diver. And those things stay with you. You don't forget those. You don't forget those faces, those little pale, you know, faces, because water does things to us. You know, it softens us up, it degrades us and stuff. That's very difficult. That's one of those things we did not anticipate. But I, again, part of my job in building that program is working with the FBI, was also in this time instituting a very robust, what we call CISD, which is a critical incident stress debriefing. And we would have professionals and psychologists debrief us whenever we came back from a recovery of human remains. And you'd have to talk to the therapist and stuff and just, you know, talk it out. But I had, you know, after one particular recovery in San Diego of a 14-year-old, 15-year-old girl who went jogging, she was on a track team after school and she was murdered by a predator. And after we recovered her, came back, you know, one of the guys came to me on the team, and he had two teenage daughters, one 15 and one 16, and they ran track, and he needed to take some time away from the team. He took a leave of absence for a year. He came, he was a counterterrorism agent, so he did his counterterrorism cases and stuff. And a year later, we talked, and they thought he was ready, and he came back and, you know, did the team. But I mean, we couldn't have divers say, "I'll only do gun recoveries. I don't want to do the child recovery."
Right,
I couldn't do that as a team leader. But I also said, if anybody has trouble with this, you have to let me know, and I'll get you get you the help that you need. And number two, I won't penalize you if you want to take some time away from the team. And when you're ready to come back, you'll be welcome back. And so that happened. I couldn't step away, obviously, because, I was the team leader, so I had an obligation there. But I also felt that I had the resources available to me to deal with some of that stuff. You know, I mean, this happened to be, ironically enough, at a time when my wife and I were having our own problems, having our own children,
right,
and things. And so this all coincided for me. And I if you've read Maureen Callahan's book about Israel Keyes,
yeah, I have.
There's a passage in there about that, about me and about that kind of stuff. And, you know, I didn't really realize that she was going to put that in the book. I don't mind it. But I don't remember talking to her so much about it, but I obviously did. And I had never seen it in print in quite that way. And it kind of impacted me a little bit. I enjoyed it. I liked it, seeing that, because that was certainly something that, like I said, that's the price we pay, and we'll all pay it for a long time, but it's just, you know, that's the obligation you just sign up for. You sign up to do the work, and you can't complain about it. You know, what we did was very important. At my retirement, my boss said, you know, he was kidding me, because I had still a few more years left before it was mandatory to retire. But he said, you know, he was chiding me about how much I was going to miss the work and how much I was going to submit. And I said, I'll miss the people, certainly.
Yeah.
And I said this to a room full of people. I said, but boss, I'm never going to miss pulling in another dead child out of a body of water.
Yeah.
And that kind of brought the room down a little bit. I didn't realize it was instinctive for me to say that. But because I'm still, you know, they still come to you in your dreams. You don't forget those things. But it was good work, and it was important work. And it was, you know, I tell you, the level of satisfaction that you had in doing the work was just, I can't think of a better calling. I don't ever want to hear the primal guttural moaning of a mother hearing it confirmed that her child was murdered. But that is an important role to play. And not a lot of people in law enforcement even get to do that, and not probably even want to do it. I certainly didn't want to do it, but I knew I felt a huge obligation to do that properly. And I talked to people about how to do that, and I talked to people who've done it before me, and I talked to, you know, grief counselors and things like that, and in ways that you can do that that help the people and do it. But yeah, but that was a whole nother TV show or book or something that I should write eventually.
Sometimes you were working at incredible depths with some, like TWA Flight 800, with the Challenger disaster. We're not talking about relatively shallow bodies of water. We're talking about, so do you end up using like deep sea diving techniques, you know?
Yeah.
More things?
Yeah, we didn't do the Challenger. We did the Columbia. The Challenger was in 86. Columbia was in 2003. So we did Columbia. Yeah, the deepest our working depth for divers was, you know, in the 230, 250 foot of seawater. And we didn't like to go that deep. We only went that deep when we had to, and that was a technical dive. But I remember we recovered a couple of organized crime victims. They were the Russian mobsters that were dumped in a lake in Northern California, two different areas of the lake. And they were several hundred feet deep. One was 400 feet, and the other was between 200 and 300 feet deep. Too deep for our divers. I didn't want to risk our divers. One of the cardinal things is you don't hurt a diver, you know, going after something else that, you know, is not going to, it's just not worth the risk. And so we have what we call remote operated vehicles of all different sizes and have all different capabilities. And so that one on that lake at 400 feet, we splashed a pretty significant remote operated vehicle that had a grabber arm and had a sonar on it and had photographic equipment on it. We found our way to the bodies using sonar and three different sonars. And we recovered the bodies. They were weighted down with gym plates, with those 45 pound gym plates.
Right.
And so we were able to kind of manipulate the body and bring it up to about 50 feet. And from there, we sent the divers down and they bagged the body, and we released the robot, and then the divers brought it up to the surface, because you don't want the body hitting the surface, because normally there was press around. Whenever we're doing operations, it was usually press around.
Right.
And stuff, and that's the last thing you want. And so the bodies were brought bagged already to the surface, and that's how we did something like that.
Right. And again, you know, even though you're talking about somebody who's involved in a criminal activity or whatever, you always talked about the respect that you wanted to show whoever you were recovering.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, in that case, there was three males and a female. Yeah, I mean, nobody deserves to be murdered, no matter how bad they are or what they do. So, yeah, I mean, they're all victims to us. There's somebody going to hopefully go to jail, you know, for that crime.
So does the driving the remote control vehicle, I mean, does that end up looking like, you know, sort
video
of
game?
A video game with the...
Yeah, absolutely. It has the two joysticks. And I mean, there's a certain... We call them pilots. They're pilots, the people that are specially trained to do that. I mean, I would do it once in a while, but I had guys, younger guys that grew up
with video games.
There were hand controllers and stuff. And there's a certain skill to it. I mean, it's a perishable skill. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And if you don't do it for a while, you get rusty and stuff. And so we trained a lot with those things. It's very mechanical and very cool to do. It has a lot of, the new ones have all these different bells and whistles and gadgets on it, but they can do a lot of stuff underwater, and they can help, you know, really advance our reach underwater, be it the depth or be it in contaminated water where you don't want to put a diver, you can put one of these things. Or a depth where you don't want to put a diver, you can put one of these things. So that it does really extend the reach of the team.
Now that you've transitioned over into more of a writing role as a screenwriter and a consultant, do you find yourself drawing on your real life cases to give your fictional stories or based on stories the grounding that you want?
Yeah, sure. I think that's the part that most writers don't know they're going to appreciate, but once they kind of, you know, interact with somebody like me, they appreciate, because I can add depth to those characters. I can add the little things, like when a guy is in the car by himself or when he's talking to his wife when he gets home from work. You know, those things can seem very cliche if you don't know, you know, the right way to do them. If you don't know really how they happen, they can be very tropey and very cliche. And I can, one of the things I pride myself on is I can avoid those cliches and I can avoid those tropes that you've seen 1,000 times, because, and it doesn't take much. It just takes a little bit of tweaking. Sometimes it's not even the words, it's how they're said and, you know, what's said and what's not said sometimes. And it just brings that level of realness and richness to a character that, you know, I think that the audience appreciates, even though you can't really put your finger on it.
And I'm the Criminal Minds fan in the room. So,
yes, she is.
Yep. I know that you did some screenwriting with Criminal Minds. Actually, I remember messaging you one night and saying, I'm watching your episode and I just saw you on screen. And you played myself at the gym.
I gave myself a cameo. Yeah. And Jim and I were in the same scene, although Jim keeps his back to the camera and I play the bartender. And that was a scene with Joe Mantegna. And it was fun. It was a great, great, great experience. I did 2 years as a consultant on Beyond Borders, which was a spinoff of Criminal Minds. We had Gary Sinise and Alana De La Garza and Daniel Henney and Annie Funky. And they're all still good friends. Gary and I probably speak once a month. Daniel and I speak more often than that. Alana is now on FBI, the Dick Wolf Show FBI, and her and I text all the time about things. And, you know, that show lasted 2 years, a great cast. Gary is an amazing human being. And then when that show ended, I got the opportunity. Jim brought me back over to the mothership. We call the mothership the regular Criminal Minds. And I was there for the last 2 seasons of Criminal Minds. And it was just a special time to be involved. I mean, I hate any show hates to go off the air, but there was so much love in that crew and that writing room. And it was just a real special time. I wish I would have been there longer, because there was so much emotions, and that cast had been together for so long and had made some great, great television. I was ultimately honored to be able to co-write one of the final episodes. I think it's the fourth one before the show ended. And that kind of got me my gravitas into the Writers Guild. And I went from there, and then I wrote on a show for Nicole Kidman last year. I spent most of the year in 2019 writing on a Nicole Kidman show, a crime show also.
Is that out yet?
No, we don't even know when and if it's going to go in production. It's for her production company. We thought she might star in it, but I think she declined that. So they were probably looking for a new lead actress for it. It was called Crime Farm. And it was interesting because it was based on a couple from the Netherlands who the wife is an MD slash profiler and the husband is a DNA expert. And they left the Netherlands and they moved to the United States and they set up what they call Crime Farm in Colorado. And so it's kind of based on, Nicole read either a book that was written about them or an article in the magazine about them. And Nicole kind of bought the rights to their story. And so I was lucky enough to be brought in as first a consultant and then meet a writer on the show. And so we wrote a whole first season, 10 episodes. They're great. They're exciting. I can't wait to hopefully hear someday that it gets made because, you know, then, you know, COVID happens and who knows, but those 10 scripts are sitting somewhere. And, you know, I worked with a great, great crew of writers. Janine Sherman-Balois was our showrunner and she was an amazing talent. She's an amazing creative talent. And hopefully it gets made because it'll be a great show. And the couple who it's based on is just a very, very interesting couple. We would FaceTime with them every couple of weeks, you know, to get different questions answered and stuff and how they work and things. And their thing is they do recreations of the crime to figure things out.
It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, they're an interesting couple. They're a really interesting couple. Yeah, and they're very, a tad eccentric and stuff. And that just made it more interesting and things like that. I mean, the calls that we used to have with them were phenomenal. It was really, really a great experience for me. And again, got me further into the writers union and in the guild and things and stuff and has led to more work and stuff. And now I've written my own pilot and we're shopping that around and, you know, we'll see.
What's your pilot about?
It's about an FBI unit that I was involved in. I was a part of, and believe it or not, you know, I was a lawyer before I went to the FBI, right? I mean, one of my squad mates here in LA was a doctor before he came to the FBI. He was literally an MD. He literally worked at UCLA Emergency Medicine. Then he left all that and became an FBI agent. But within the FBI, we have something called an operational medical program. So we would be medics. So I was an EMT. He was obviously a doctor. We had everything from paramedics to RNs to registered nurses and EMTs and everything. So it would be a collateral duty. We would train together and we would do wound care, emergency wound care, all that kind of stuff. We had our own ambulance and we would go out on every raid and every arrest. You know, there would be one of us with SWAT all the time and we would actually do all the SWAT training and tryouts and stuff. So I call it TACMED. It's a tactical medical crew. It's a bunch of FBI agents who go out and into these high risk environments and they have to balance, you know, their own authorized use of deadly force with their medical oath of first do no harm, right? That's the medical oath is first do no harm. And yet these are people that are authorized to use deadly force. And so there's that dynamic in it, you know, what wins the day, you know, sometimes, and can you let, you know, a mistake either way can cost you your own life or somebody else's life, right? If you hesitate in using deadly force sometimes, because you think I'm obligated to not use that, you know, to save them, that could cost you your life. And if you hesitate applying emergency medical techniques to somebody because you think they're a bad guy and you have to be an adversary, then that could cost them their life. And so there's that dichotomy of obligations, of oaths, kind of that these people face. And sometimes you're actually saving the life of somebody you just shot. You know what I mean? Or one of your colleagues just shot and now you're saving their life. Or they just killed one of your colleagues, even worse, and you have to save their life.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Right? Wow. That sounds tremendous.
Yeah.
So we're hoping, we're still shopping it around. We're like, you know, it's a procedural. It's a police procedural, which, you know, has been, you know, a staple in network TV for a long time, except that, you know, there's very few of them. The streamers, the Netflixes and stuff, you know, they don't like to make originals out of those things, which is a shame because they buy them. They'll buy 15 seasons worth of Criminal Minds and put it on a streaming service and everybody, but then Netflix originals or somebody originals, they look down their noses at police procedurals sometimes. You know, it's not the heady or the weighty, you know, creativity, but I love them. The audiences love them. They like everything wrapped up in an hour sometimes and, you know, and that's good and stuff. And so, you know, we'll see.
Well, and it's an interesting art form too, because the best procedurals typically also have a through line. And so there's story arc. So there's the case of the week, if you will, or the, you know, whatever they're trying to solve. And I get the fact that you've got 48 minutes or so with commercials and you've got to tell a compelling story and wrap that up. But then, as Kristen knows very well, as a fan, you also have the through line of the development of the characters and their lives and, you know, what's going on outside the office or whatever, you know, wherever they work.
Yeah, so, surely. And the problem is usually that you don't really get enough time to do that unless you're successful a couple of seasons. Like if you look back at, you really start hearing about the characters' backstories in season two, really season three, four, maybe even later than that, because there's so much pressure to get ratings. And to get ratings, you have to have the dynamic situations and you have to have the risk and the threats and all that stuff. And following them home is really not possible in your first season, even your second season sometimes, because that slows the action down. You know what I mean? And so there's, and there's so many cooks in this kitchen. There's, you know, the network executives and the studio people, and, you know, everybody has their own different wants and desires for the show and stuff. And so some, you know, whoever wins out, sometimes that's the fate of the show is in the hands of those people making those decisions. And yeah, we would all, you know, that's why writers always want to do streaming shows, because you get 10 episodes of a season and you can really delve. It's really like a 10-hour movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can delve into the characters in the background. Sure. And that's why most writers, you know, like they all want to work on these streaming shows. But me, I just want to work on a network procedural. I want to make 22, 24 episodes a year, you know, and I have the ideas. I have 30 years worth of ideas to draw upon. So I won't run out of ideas. I can guarantee you that. But, it's a different world. You hear many writers say, I want to work in procedural television, but I actually do.
Mm-hmm. So do we have a working title for your pilot?
It's just called TACMED. And it's because the team was called TACMED, Tactical Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the working title of the project right now. I'm trying to get, you know, we're out there trying to get people interested and I've written the pilot. Yeah, and it's gone through many revisions, and I've gotten a lot of good notes on it. I've had some network executives read it. I've had some people, you know, in the business a long time read it and give me some feedback, and I've incorporated those notes back into the script, and it's gotten better with each draft, with each revision. It gets better and better and better. It's a process. You know, your first draft is supposed to suck. Right. I mean, that's just the process of the writing.
That's the way it is, right?
Too many writers sit at the keyboard going, oh, it's not right. Well, you know, they call it the vomit draft. Just vomit it. Just get it out. Just get it out on paper. You know, you can't fix something that's not written, and everything needs to be fixed. And so it's a very humbling process. You know, your first draft is never going to be good. And, you know, mm-hmm. and how many years he's been writing, the first draft is usually not good. And that's what it's about. Writing is rewriting. And it's all about getting feedback and being able to take constructive criticism and seeing, you know, where the faults lie in your story and stuff. And sometimes you're too close to it to see it. And it's great to have that kind of feedback. And that's why
students need to hear this.
I love working in a writer's room because that's what you have. You have 6 or 8 or 10 totally creative people just throwing stuff onto a whiteboard and watching that process happen and watching the story get better and better and better with everyone's input. It's just exciting. For me, it's an exciting place to be. And right now I'm really hoping to get employed in 2021 on a show like FBI. Like, you know, you think you'd need a writer who spent 27 years in the FBI on a show called FBI, but haven't had that opportunity yet, but hopefully that'll come in this new staffing season that's coming up.
COVID obviously has impacted all of us. You're in Los Angeles and Kristen and I are not at this point. Of course, I worked in LA for a number of years. What's the dynamic now? If you're having a discussion, everything is virtual pretty much. And
yeah, like I know writers that are writing for Dick Wolf's FBI show. It's all virtual writer's room. It's all like this, like three of us are talking now, except there's 6 or 8 or 10 people on the Zoom. And they're doing, you know, they're going through storylines and they're giving suggestions and they're working out the bugs in the story and stuff. But I just had a friend of mine over for Christmas dinner and she's on one of those shows and it's just not as good. It's just when you're in the room together,
right.
And you have two or three writer's assistants that are kind of working the whiteboard and doing that. It's just, I don't know, there's an energy. Writers and creatives have this energy that when you're in the same room, and I'm a big believer in the physical world, there's a physical energy that happens. And when you're together in the same room, the synergy of those creative energies being in the same breathing space causes it to be greater than the sum of its parts. And you don't have that over Zoom because you don't have those creative energies mixing in the same breathing space. And I know that sounds esoteric, that sounds kind of new agey and stuff, but I truly believe in that I've been in those rooms and I've felt that energy and I've felt it all mixed together. And the, like I said, it's greater than the sum of its parts.
Well, speaking as someone who's been teaching over Zoom for the last couple of months, it really is not the same as it is when you're in a classroom with your kids. It is very, very different. So I'm 100% with you on that one, Bobby, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I a lot of people think this is, you know, I hate the phrase new normal, but a lot of people think that this will be a long lasting effect, but I don't think so. I think in Hollywood, writers' rooms, as soon as they can open again safely, they will open again safely for the reasons I mentioned, in that I think creative people sharing the same physical space is important. And there is an energy that's just better. It's just better. It's just not there through Zoom, through virtual gatherings.
Much in the same way you've got to get the actors together on set to help tell the story. You know, you can't tell that story without those creative people getting together to build the story from the ground up.
Right, right. No one would ever suggest that we could do this. You can film me and then film Bill and then put that scene together. You know, it just wouldn't work, right? Even though oftentimes you don't see me and Bill on the camera at the same time. Mm-hmm. But you still need to be there. You still need to, I still need to be looking at Bill when I'm saying my lines. He needs to be looking at me when he's saying his line, that kind of stuff.
And Kristen, you know, so has to, you know, Kristen has to tell us how we could do it better. No. Let's go again.
Yeah. I mean, all of our hopes is, you know, we start, you know, the vaccines and we start seeing the numbers, you know, move in a, you know, in a direction that we need them to move. And, you know, and I think there's going to be a collective sigh of relief. And I'm still an optimist. And I still, you know, think that, you know, these two vaccines or three vaccines now are going to be able to really help save a lot of lives and really get this thing down and under control. I could be wrong. I was sitting here last March going, oh, by Memorial Day, everything will be better and we'll have a good summer. And you know, it didn't turn out that way, but I'm still hoping. And I'm hoping that by Easter, we're going to be looking a lot different and people are going to start, you know, and that's kind of the staffing season for writers in Hollywood, right? Is like runs from February to May and then they start writing in June or May and June. I'm still hoping there's going to be a new traditional, we missed it this year, but we'll go back to a traditional staffing season and then, you know, writers' rooms will spin up in May and June and everybody will be back together writing good creative TV shows that are going to start filming in August and being airing in September.
Something to look at.
That's really wishful thinking, but I'm still thinking that way.
I like it. Believe it or not, we just filled up 2 episodes.
Oh, great. Wow. Terrific.
Yeah, this was absolutely tremendous, Bobby. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very humbled by anybody wanting to opinions of anything.
This is great.
We're going to want to do it again, if that's okay.
Absolutely. But that's fine. Yeah. It's perfectly fine.
That sounds fantastic. This was
wonderful.
That's the great benefit of podcasts like this and the true crime world in general, is that it can bring to light some of these cases that can be cleared either because the perpetrator is dead or they actually go and find the perpetrator, because it keeps that case alive and stuff. And then that's the benefit of this new true crime world, is that, you know, cases are going to get solved that the government, be it state, local, or federal, just didn't have the resources to dedicate to it.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.